all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Hello, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me on. Thank you for having me on. This is an incredible honor.
Well, thank you very much. I understand that you're running into a little traffic out there. Hopefully you're pulled over right now or in the back seat.
No, I'm good. It's Washington, D.C. That's the best thing you can actually count on is traffic, no matter what day of the week it is.
That's true, and pretty much no matter what town it is anymore. So, Flo, tell me about how you got into the Army in the first place.
Like you mentioned earlier on, I came in as 12 years old. My father, I had never met my biological father, and I was lucky enough to be adopted by Larry, who has been the greatest thing in the world for me. He's an American from Gary, Indiana. He got to meet my mother when I was about 3 years old, and, you know, he fell in love, and he took me in as a son. Mm-hmm. And so when I was about 12 years old, he decided, like, hey, you know, let's move back to the United States. And he talked to my mom about it, and my mom was like, well, you got to ask Flo about this, you know, moving back to the U.S. because, you know, he's a French kid. And he tricked me by asking me about whether or not I love McDonald's and if I wanted to be Michael Jordan. And obviously those were two answers that were yeses. And next thing you know, I end up in Palatine, Illinois, of all places, which is very different than Paris, France. So that was the start of my journey into the United States.
All right. So you grew up in Indiana. Well, after 12, correct?
So I grew up in France, and then my dad's right. from Indiana, and then I actually grew up in when we moved to the United States, I was in Palatine, Illinois.
Okay, that's what I thought. All right. Tell me about your uncle. That was kind of the interesting story. Your uncle Abdu?
Yes. So, it's one of the things when I talk about my uncle, I try to describe it as this individual that when we grow up as kids, we're all infatuated with one individual. Some of us is my mom, our dad, a brother, a sister, an uncle, a cousin. And to me, it was my Uncle Abdu. I loved him more than anything else in the world. I wanted to be just like him. I remember I was just so stuck to him. I used to want to hang out everywhere he went. Even when he went to the bathroom, I was like, I want to be next to you. And he's like, no, you can't go into the bathroom with me. All right, kiddo. And so I was, in hindsight, I was like that really annoying a sibling. But he meant everything to me. And one of those things about him is that, you know, he's Algerian. He was born in Algeria, which is in North Africa. And he was really, really deeply involved in the Muslim faith. And he became an imam at a young age. And so when a terrorist organization called the GIA decided to come into Algeria in late 1980s, early 1990s, to take over the country and preach own version of Islam, which we're very accustomed to, which is what you're seeing with Al-Qaeda, what you're seeing with ISIS.
Mm-hmm.
He decided to step up and fight against it. So he didn't take I used to say he put the book down and put on a military uniform, but he never actually did that. What he did is that he kept the book with him, but he put on a military uniform and he decided to go fight against these people. And in February of 1996, he was while serving in the Algerian Army, Special Forces, he was shot, beheaded, and dismembered, and put in a box and sent back to my grandfather.
Oh, my. Oh, wow. I didn't realize that is what had occurred. That must have been very traumatic for you.
Yeah, it was. I was 13 years old, and, you know, it was my dad. My dad told me about what had happened, and my mom had left, and I didn't even have an opportunity to talk to my mom about it because she had left early on after she had heard about what had happened to her brother to go back to Algeria to bury him because they got a 24-hour burial, and it was tough. It was one of the toughest moments of my life because I didn't know how to react.
Right.
That was probably the biggest piece about it. And I wanted to be part of the solution, but I didn't know how to react. I didn't know how to understand that my favorite person in the world was dead.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So after that, you I'm assuming that you finished. Where did you go to college?
So I went to college in 2001.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember thinking that I was so young when my uncle was killed. So you fast forward a few years and time usually allows you to either cope with things or make different decisions. But I know I knew in the back of my head at that point, it's like, hey, no matter what I do, I'm going to go to the military. So, but I was a pretty decent runner.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the opportunity to go run in college and nothing was happening. Nothing was happening around the world in terms of finding those individuals. So I didn't know where to make my mark. And so I thought, okay, I'm going to go out there, go to college, get an education, and run track. And then after that, I'm going to join the military.
Okay. And so that's what you did. Did you look around at the different services? We've got a minute to go before we're going to take a break, Flo. We're talking with Flo Groberg, who's the author of a book entitled 8 Seconds of Courage. He went from immigrant to a Medal of Honor recipient, and after we come back after the news, we're going to find out a little bit more about how that occurred. But what made you decide to join the Army?
So to answer your previous question, I actually ended up going to University of Maryland. And
Maryland.
And one of those things was when I went to University of Maryland, I joined ROTC for a little bit. But with running track, he actually made it very hard for me. So I decided, okay, I'm going to focus on track. And once I graduate, I'm going to go out there and enlist in the United States Army and go to officer candidate school and so on.
Okay. I got to hold you off. We got to take a real quick break here. We'll be back in a couple of minutes. Don't go away. You're listening to Veterans Radio right now. And we're back on Veterans Radio with our own Medal of Honor recipient as our guest today. His name is Flo Groberg. He received his Medal of Honor in 2015 for actions in Afghanistan in 2012. And we're going to get there eventually to our audience. So, Flo, you mentioned that you were at the University of Maryland. You graduated from the University of Maryland. And at that point, this was after 9/11, you decided to join up. So tell us a little bit about how you got into the Army.
No, so I graduated in 2001 out of high school, and you know, I was just naturalized as a U.S. citizen in February 2001 during my senior high school, and then my freshman year, 9/11 happened, and that was one of those moments that really you know changed my life, and
mm-hmm.
the same way it changed millions of other lives in this country. And I will never forget having a conversation with my father. That evening after the phone lines were open again, and telling him that I wanted to drop out of school and join the U.S. Army and become an Army Ranger and going out there and fighting any individual that was involved with this. And my dad gave me, like he had done my entire life, a life lesson. And he said, okay, son, you are reacting with emotions, but when I gave you my name, when I adopted you and I gave you the name Groberg, I asked of you one responsibility, which was when you start something, you finish it.
At
that point, you know, it took me a little while to accept that, but I realized what he meant, and I meant that, you know, I need to go out there and get my degree. And after that, we're joining the US Army. So after I finished school, I went in and enlisted in the US Army. It took a little bit of a time because I was a French citizen as well, and I renounced my French citizenship, which took about 18 months. But once I was done, I was enlisting the U.S. Army and to go out there and be a difference maker in this world where we see evil every single day. And, you know, we live in the greatest country in the world, but the reality is we only live in this country that we consider the best in the world because we have the best people in the world.
Right. I agree with you. I agree with you entirely on that. But the Army turned out not to be a little bit more difficult than you anticipated because you went off to Ranger school.
I love you say that. So look, I never expected the Army to be easy, but my goodness, was the Army Ranger School one of those difficult tasks? It kicked my butt over and over again. Every time I thought I had a little advantage on the Ranger School, it came back to me and told me, "You don't got it, boy." And so I went through it, but you know what? It's about never giving up. And thankfully, as you read in 8 Seconds of Courage, I had some really good friends and some really good mentors during my time that allowed me to keep fighting and never give up. And I went through it. I was lucky enough that I went straight through 62 days of Ranger School. And so that's something I can be really definitely proud of. But it also got me ready for Afghanistan.
Well, that is true. I can, you know, we've had the opportunity to talk to many people who have been Rangers or Special Forces and so forth, or pilots and so forth. You know, it's just, you just have to keep going and keep going and keep going. And you do, you run into some great friends who are, you know, who motivate you. And of course, as you mentioned, the mentors, you know, you don't, some of them you don't like at the time, but you look back on it and you realize how important they were in your life and getting you through whatever that program was that you went in through.
No, you're absolutely right. One of the examples is Gallardo. You know, Silver Star recipient. I was out there in the Korngal when Todd Genta received his Medal of Honor, and you know, based on actions that happened in 2007. And Gallardo was that guy. He was literally that guy. Like, everybody knew who he was because he understood, and all the Ranger instructors understood who he was, what he had gone through. He got shot in the head.
Oh.
During that battle, and he got back up and continued on with a mission. I mean, you're talking about a standard of being the outstanding military service member. That's Gallardo for you. And he was in my Ranger class, and everybody knew who Gallardo was, and he was a pain in the butt for me. But when I was struggling, I saw this different side of Gallardo, and he challenged me. He was there with me. He's like, "Hey, man, if you're going to quit tomorrow, I'm going to quit with you." I was like, "You can't quit, man. You're Gallardo. Like, you're the hero guy."
Yeah.
He's like, "No, and I don't care what anybody says or thinks about me. I'm here with you. I'm going to support you. I'm going to guide you." And he changed my entire perspective. And there's a reason why I went through that school, and the reason why I became somewhat of I was a sufficient and decent officer is because I had the opportunity to serve next to such an incredible individual.
Mm-hmm. Was he going? I'm trying to remember. Was he going through as a sergeant, or was he also in OCS?
No, he was actually going through as a sergeant. So he was in 173rd at the time, and he was enlisted. And for him to actually be a first sergeant in 173rd, actually sergeant first class in 173rd, he needed to get his tab. And so the funny thing about Gallardo is that he'd been in the regiment for a while. And when he was in the 173rd, you know, he served as an NCO, and he just never got the opportunity to go to Ranger School because he kept getting deported.
Well, I was going to say, he was not the youngest guy in your class, I'm sure.
Oh, no, he was not. So he finally got a break. So when we all think about a break, we think about vacation. No, he opted to go to Ranger School, and I give him a lot of props.
Yeah, I've met some people like that. All right, so we go to Ranger School. You made it through, and you're all excited, and the next thing you know, they send you off to Afghanistan, right?
And here I am. So I'm in Afghanistan, and I'm a second lieutenant with no experience. And Colonel Pearl at the time was the battalion commander. You know, he brings me into his office. He talks to me about the responsibilities that I have for Dagger 4 Platoon. He tells me I'm going to take over Dagger 4 Platoon out of Combat Apples Harnessing Miracle. And he tells me about the unit and the folks, what they've been doing for the last couple of months, and what responsibilities. And I remember just listening. In the back of my head, I'm thinking like, "Oh my God, this is real. Oh my God, this is real." And I walked out of his office. I kept thinking about it. I have no experience. I've never been shot at, from my understanding. And where I've seen it. And here I am about to take over this unit with these incredible individuals who have been in one of the most kinetic places in Afghanistan or in the world. But I had a responsibility to take care of them. So when I got there, the first person I sought out was platoon sergeant. And his name is Corey Steele. He's on first class Corey Steele. Mm-hmm. I told him, I said, hey, I have no experience, but I'm going to need you to guide me, mentor me, and teach me how to be the most effective leader. And we had a good conversation. He told me to shut up for the next 7 days to watch and listen to what was happening around me. And after 7 days, he would, him and I would get back together and come up with the next plan. And tell you what, I was lucky enough to come into a unit with a man like Corey Steele, who really took the time and effort to teach me how to be an effective leader.
Well, I'll tell you, just from my experience, although I was not a real live officer, the enlisted people were the ones that got me through, especially the experienced ones, because they knew what they'd been there. And, you know, as you mentioned, going in as a young second lieutenant and taking over a platoon, it's got to be frightening. But, you know, you have to show your courage and show them that, you know what you're doing. And it's a good thing that you had a sergeant that could show you that you know what you're doing.
Yeah, but I wasn't scared about the job. I was actually nervous about, as an officer, making decisions that would get people killed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
that was my biggest fear. And I knew, my dad had always taught me about, trust my training and not be weak. And I'm not trying to, the word weak is really negative. I think the word weak in combat really refers to the idea of not making the decision.
Right.
Being too scared to make a decision. You know, combat, it's all about that one split second where you go right or left.
Correct.
And that's it. That is it. I mean, and you have to live with it. And if you go left, it was supposed to be right. If you go right and it was supposed to be left, you have to live with the consequences of that decision. I was nervous about that.
Well, I understand that because you were in the Peck River Valley in Afghanistan, which happens to be the most dangerous place in the world. That's in quotes. And you had to come in, to face your own greenness. And I think, the way I interpreted that was, how am I going to react if somebody starts shooting at me? And as you said, you had to make the decisions of, do they go right, do they go left? And evidently, I think you probably did a pretty good job, it sounds like.
Well, I'll tell you what, I had the best of the best around me.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only reason why I did an okay job. My job was the simplest job in the world, which is make decisions and allow your NCOs and your soldiers to go out there and operate and execute.
Mm-hmm. All right. So,
I knew that I had the best of the best around me. That they were going to go out there and do the best job.
Mm-hmm. I like to think that we were all surrounded by the best of the best, and most of the time that was true. I think. So you spent, how long did you spend in Afghanistan your first time?
9 months for sure.
Okay, and then you came back, and where did you go from there?
From there, we were back in garrison, and I did a job as an executive officer for Alpha Company. I moved from Dagger Company, went to Alpha Company 212 Infantry out of 4th Brigade, Fort Carson.
Oh, okay.
And then I was selected to run a specialized security detail for, at the time, Colonel Mingus, who was the brigade commander for 4th ID.
Okay. All right. So you went back to Afghanistan in 2012, correct?
I did.
Okay. We're talking with Flo Groberg, who's a Medal of Honor recipient, who's just released his story of 8 seconds of courage, a soldier story, going from immigrant to Medal of Honor. And you wrote this along with Tom, I gotta make sure I give him the credit too, Tom Salio.
Yeah.
And, I really encourage people to get this book. It's not that long, but everything is packed into it that you could ever want in a true story of courage, for a young man especially. So you go back and as part of this security force, correct?
Yeah, I ran a security detail for, at the time, Colonel Mingus. who ran 4th ID, 4th Brigade operation. So he was actually in charge of all of Eastern Afghanistan.
Oh,
Afghanistan
okay.
At that time.
All right. So you were in charge of protecting all of the, you know, the colonels and so forth that were going in and around the area. Or were you attached to one man?
Yeah, one man, and actually a Sergeant Major as well, who worked for them, which was Command Sergeant Major Griffin. And so I had a team of 6, including myself, where I had my first class rank. I had Sergeant Mahoney, Specialist Badarama. I had a Specialist C-Corps, and a Specialist O-Chart with me as well.
So what were your duties with him? Was it to kind of take him around to meet with the Afghan tribal leaders and so forth?
So he had his mission was he owned the entire operations for Eastern Afghanistan. So between meeting with his own unit, which was 65% of our mission, to meeting with all the Afghan partners that we had, as well as the government officials, my job was to plan and make sure that his security was set in place, coordinate with the receiving units everywhere we went, which was outside of Jalalabad or Kop Fenty or Fos Fenty in Afghanistan. So I would call in and tell the units, hey, Colonel Mingus is coming at this time, at this hour, and this location to do this. Please have this type of security out there. So I coordinate all the security elements for 45 different L stations across Eastern Afghanistan.
Wow. So you arranged all the logistics, the helicopters or whatever transportation that he needed.
Yeah, that was my job. I mean, actually, it was a pretty simple job. Not a lot of years. I loved it. I remember thinking about it. I was like, man, I got the best job in the world. Because everybody wants to make sure that the boss has the best receiving reception. Mm-hmm. When he comes out there, and so when I called, I was like, hey, the boss is coming tomorrow. Make sure you got this. And I'm like, oh, okay, we got this. But obviously, as we get forward, and August 7 was not the same reception when I was on the phone, and August 8 was a completely different story.
Let's go into that. You ready?
Yeah. So okay. August 7th, I called. The boss was having a commander's meeting, and so most of the senior leaders that were part of our unit were at Jalalabad and at Kop Fenty. And so, but I called Kop Fayez, because Combat Apples Fayez, that night, and I'll never forget this, because I called and I was talking to a major in one of those special units based out of the 101st, and I was talking to a major. I told him, I was like, hey, tomorrow I'm coming to your combat outpost with Colonel Mingus, Colonel Walrath, and an Afghan general, and 2 more battalion commanders, and 2 command sergeant majors, and we're going to go to the Kunar Provincial Security Meeting. Now, I'm going to need you to provide us with 15 people as an escort as we walk outside your base.
Mm-hmm.
The guy kind of listened to me and told me on the phone, like, hey, we're going to walk to Ralph Breyer. So I can't give you that. But we're going to secure it. And so I'll never forget this, because I put him on mute, and I had the adjutant, Lieutenant Cassidy, next to me at the time. And I was like, and I told Lieutenant Cassidy, I'm like, hey, man, watch, I'm going to repeat my request. And this guy's going to tell me to F off.
Mm-hmm.
And I did just that. And guess what? He pretty much told me to F off. And he hung up on me. And so the night before, I was thinking about it, and as I went to bed, I was like, "Oh, you know what? He must have been having a bad day. He's going to realize that his boss's boss is going to show up tomorrow."
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of makes sense for him to be there to receive him. But on August 8th, when we landed and caught fires, he wasn't there.
Oh.
He had left 15 minutes prior. What he did that kicks my butt to this day is the fact that he actually cleared their area, but he left.
Right. And this area was turned out not to be cleared.
No, not at all. Because we were attacked by 2 suicide bombers.
Can you just describe for our audience, if you can, what happened on the 8th of August?
As we landed, caught fire, somebody out with fires, you know, he wasn't there, so I had to adjust my team, and I put my team sergeant on first class Brian Brink up front to control the pace of our walk, and I put C-Corps behind him, who was always in charge of making sure, you know, you secure Sergeant Major Griffin, and we had diamond formation. And I was always at the rear of the diamond formation, but in this case, I want to be at the spear of it because for eyes on. And so I put O-Chart, private first class O-Chart. I put in my position. I told him, hey, anything that happens tonight or today, this morning, I need you to pick the boss, which was Colonel Mingus at the time, and take him to safety.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, yeah, roger that, sir. And so we decided to walk out. And it was 1,100-meter movement, 700 meters into the movement. As we're about to cross this bridge, we saw two motorcycles coming, you know, full speed towards us. One of those things that Brink and I did that day that really probably made the biggest impact was the fact that we decided to take Afghan National Army and put them up front.
Mm-hmm.
We realized that we didn't have enough security. We did not have enough manpower. And so we took the Afghan National Army guys that were sitting around the base and we put them up front. And one of them did an incredible job. When the motorcycles were coming towards us, he raised his rifle and started screaming dart, which forced the first motorcycle to drop its bike and then forced the second one to drop his bike. And then they started running away, which at that point I realized we're in deep trouble.
Right.
I witnessed that. And there was a guy, maybe 20, 22 years old, that came out of a structure to our left, walking backwards and 180-degree turn and then 90-degree turn towards us. And, you know, I commend myself towards him. And I hit him, grabbed him, realized he had suicide vest. And I tried to everything that I had in me to throw him away as quickly as possible and as far as possible. And he detonated.
Yeah, he blew up. He detonated.
Yeah.
Ooh.
He detonated.
And somehow you survived this. You were badly wounded, but a number of your comrades did not survive. Some of your good friends.
Yeah, I somehow lived, and you know, it's crazy part of the whole situation. Human Sergeant Griffin, Major Gray, Major Kennedy, and State Department USAID Reggie, I thought they were all killed. You know, I had a dude that made the vest at my feet, and that threw me 20 feet away, but they didn't kill me. I had four of my buddies who were nowhere near the blast site get killed. And I also forced a second suicide bomber that was still in the building trying to come out detonate.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're lucky enough that we all didn't die because the second one detonated inside the building.
Wow. It sounds like the whole thing was obviously well planned with so many distractions, you know, to divert your attention from the actual real bad guys.
Yeah, well, that year they had the Taliban had the idea it was called the secular attack. So they were waiting for it. And you know what? They saw an opportunity. They went for it. So, yes. Was it planned? 100%.
Mm-hmm.
Did it go as well as it wanted it to? No, it didn't. We all, the majority of us survived. But they killed four incredible Americans. I'm pretty sure what happened after that, a couple weeks later, I'm not going to get detail due to classification. But U.S. Army did a pretty good job to go find those people.
Yeah, they went and found them.
Yes, that.
So you ended up severely injured. And ended up in Germany, and then you ended up at Walter Reed. Is that correct?
That's correct. First thought was Longstuhl, Germany, where I woke up looking at John Davis from the band Korn.
Oh.
And after that, it was like surreal. I was like, oh my God, like, am I dreaming about you? Like, why the heck would I be dreaming about you? And he was there. He was there with the U.S. tour, by the way. kudos to USO. Kudos to USO for keep sending some stars and athletes and movie folks as well as musicians to come out there and support us, because that makes a difference.
It does. It truly does. I mean, 50 years ago, we couldn't wait for the USO to show up. They're very important. So they moved you to Walter Reed, and you had, a lot of, you spent 3 years there, didn't you?
So 3 years, but really, it was about 2 years worth of injuries, and I'm lame salvage. So I decided to elect to get my leg cut off, and I fought for my leg for quite a while. But, I was lucky to be surrounded by incredible doctors and incredible nurses.
And you have to read the book. I'd love to get into all the details of these things. We got about 4 minutes left, Flo. The book is 8 Seconds of Courage. It's a soldier's story from immigrant to Medal of Honor recipient. Tell me what it was like when you got the call that they were going to award you this Medal of Honor.
Good best story of the day. Heads down, I was working for the agency, one agency with three letters, and I was in a spot where I had no cell phone service. And here I go, walking out, I just had lunch, and I get a call on my cell phone. I'm like, oh my goodness, what the heck is this? The answer is like, hey, this is Colonel Sweeney from the Pentagon. I just want to let you know that you're going to be receiving a call from one senior official at the Pentagon on 21 September. He told me the year, 2015. Is this a good number for the call? I'm like, sure. Yes, sir. And he hung up the phone. And so I told my fiance at the time, I was like, hey, I'm about to get a call from someone. I have no idea what it is, but apparently they're calling me about like from Pentagon. So I understood that I've been put in for the Distinguished Service Cross, but I never thought it would come from the president or any senior high ranking official. So I was like, man, I might have been in trouble. What did I do? So seriously, I was like, I'm in trouble. And then I got a call. And she's next to me because we took the day off, half day off, and there was President Obama telling me that I was going to receive the medal. And that was one of those conversations that will never forget the rest of my life. First of all, I respect the heck out of this man, as a leader. But the way he talked to me and the way he represented the guys that were killed, I can never, ever in my life thank him enough.
It's a very emotional chapter to read, Flo. And I encourage people to go out and get this book, 8 Seconds of Courage, A Soldier's Story. We've got about a minute to go, and I wanted to give you the opportunity to promote what you're doing at Boeing Aircraft. What is it that you're doing with Boeing?
I'm the luckiest person in the world. I was given the opportunity to work for one of the greatest companies in the world, and hands down, without a doubt, for our military service members. And I run all veterans programs at Boeing Company, and we're out there trying to fight to make sure that every one of the service members, veterans and spouses, get the opportunity to go out there and find the next passion in their lives and make a difference, to continue serving the community while having the right career track that they deserve. And we're also trying to fight for those folks who are struggling with PTSD and suicidal ideation, just like I did.
Right.
And, we want to let them know that, follow us, hit me up, talk to me, look what I'm doing, and follow what Boeing is doing, because we're out there partnering up with the best organizations in the country to make sure that we give you an opportunity to succeed. If you're struggling, I've been there. I've struggled. I need that support system. And guess what? It took a lot of effort, but we're going to make it.
Well, I want to get in touch with you to find out more about that, Flo. That's our music coming up to the end of the hour. I want to thank you very much for being on our program, and congratulations on your Medal of Honor. And it's been a privilege to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Take care.
All right, that was Flo Groberg. His book is 8 Seconds of Courage, and until next week, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans' Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.